Satan and friends. Our mutual studies have thus far been largely, but not entirely, concerned with the attainment of mystical awareness, of union with God, and with the divine life throughout all nature and within all beings. I have wondered, as I prepared this talk for this morning, whether this morning we are going to inquire into a subject restricted to historical epochs of 2,000 years ago, and far earlier we might have broken a contact with our opening studies. Not really so, friends. Actually, our two subjects are intimately allied. For as my title, which you've just heard named, indicates, although no longer relatively public as of old, the ancient mystery tradition not only survives, but continues to be fully active, even if somewhat more secretly than heretofore. Furthermore, the actual purpose, as far as existing knowledge permits us to know, the actual purpose for the establishment and function of the ancient mysteries and the practice of meditation have precisely the same and identical objectives, namely, as I have said, spiritual awareness. Both of them, occult ceremonial for today and contemplation for the last two meetings together, were founded directly for the fulfillment of human aspirations that are timeless, aspirations towards the gaining of direct personal experience of union with the divine presence within and throughout all nature and all beings, and yes, if you like, all human beings. And so, as we will see, the two ceremonies and the two subjects are indeed intimately allied, although separated in time, apparently, by a vast period. As we go along, and those of you who have already studied our subject, you will see that the touch of the rod of power upon the head, a very solemn part of the ceremony of initiation in days of old, the touch of the rod of power, or thyrsus as it was called, in the hand of the initiating hierophant, always had the same effect, the attainment of spiritual illumination. Hierophant, yes, it occurs to me suddenly that that word may be somewhat new to certain of you. It's a Greek word, and it means one who explains sacred things. And it was the title bestowed upon the highest adepts in the temples of the mysteries of old. And they were the great teachers and the actual initiators of the candidates who were admitted to those temples. And so this also was a means to open the consciousness, not only by regular meditation and contemplation of the divine, but also by external assistance, by the bringing of power invoked from on high through the initiator, through the thyrsus, directly upon the crown of the head of the candidate, who thus was brought into contact with the divine presence. Yes, it is also recorded, I remember, that when that very dramatic event occurred, the actual procedure of initiation, and the rod of power touched the crown of the head, the candidate generally lost physical consciousness and the body was laid upon the ground and preserved in the care of the initiate's presence. Then, of course, consciousness of the higher self was free and able to enter more fully, when thus free, into the great realizations for which the ceremony was performed. So now, let us look, shall we, as far as knowledge has been permitted, into these mysteries of ancient days, the method of their dramatic performance, and their designed effects upon those who were privileged to be admitted to them. Well, what do we find? We find that they were very secret, that the word mysteries very well describes them, for very little is actually known, as we'll see later, of what really occurred. Very solemn vows had to be repeated first. Vows of absolute secrecy, we understand. And miracle as it is, as we'll see a little later, though I'm going in advance of my study, miracle though it is, friends, right on down, yes, even today, no one would seem ever to have broken their vow of absolute secrecy as to what really occurred. Indeed, it was under severe penalties, even death itself, that the privileged ones found their way into the temple of the mysteries of old. And if, having passed through the door, itself a wonderful event, presumably, if proved worthy, and after severe tests, they were admitted and even passed through ceremony after ceremony, the final goal was ultimately attained. Adeptship, or perfected humanity. This was the goal, and was by certain initiates wholly attained. we find, looking back into history, upon which we are largely dependent, but not entirely, the ancient mysteries were established and enacted from the very remotest time. But we know of them in Egypt, Chaldea, Crete, and Greece. And in Greece, for all at least 1,000 years, these mysteries were enacted, and later even, yes, in Rome, in the earliest days of the Roman Empire. As far then as knowledge permits, we learn that the sacred mysteries were enacted in the ancient temples by the hierophants and other ritual officials for the benefit of and the instruction of the candidates. I find that the word mysteries is derived from the Greek word muo, muo, which meant to close the mouth, reference, I presume, to the vow of secrecy. For secrecy was preserved, and every symbol connected with the ceremonies had a profound hidden meaning below the objectively observed symbol and actions themselves. But not only in Greece, friends, but the mysteries were in almost every country of old. A series of dramatic performances in which the mysteries of cosmogony, that's creation, throughout the universe, throughout nature in general, were personified by hierophants and neophytes. These personified, yes, they enacted the part of various divine powers, gods and goddesses, meaning superhuman and archangelic officials. They dramatically repeated supposed scenes from their respective order in solar and planetary activities. In Egypt, they were wonderfully and beautifully, as the pictorial portrayals show us, they were wonderfully and beautifully enrobed with strange headdresses, all symbolical. The ram, you remember, the ibis, the vulture, and the serpentine headdresses, for example. Each of these headdresses and the other ornaments were appropriate emblems of the aspect of creative power which the particular official represented. I haven't time now to go into that aspect of our subject. This regalia, however, I may say, and the associated dramatic actions were then explained in their hidden meanings to the candidates for initiation, and thereafter more fully unfolded in their previously secretly revealed philosophic doctrines. There were five, I find, from historical references, different enactments of the mysteries in ancient Greece itself. The Cretan, the Dionysian or Bacchic, greatly misunderstood. The Orphic, the Samothracian, the Aesculapian, specially directed towards healing and serving under Hippocrates, and perhaps greatest and most widely spread of all, the Eleusinian Mysteries. This is one of the most famous of these ceremonial orders, the Eleusinian Mysteries. And they were named, as doubtless you know, under the city, some 12 miles southeast of Athens, where perhaps the most historic of all the Greek mysteries were performed. There was another smaller town called Agri, where the lesser mysteries were performed. Allow me to describe the events as they occurred in Greece of ancient days. Perhaps some of us were there, if you believe in reincarnation and the unfoldment of the inner self, life by life, may it not be that our interest in these matters now is derived from a repetition of our touch with the mysteries of old. At any rate, every September, for 7 days, the citizens of Greece and of other countries, yes, oh yes, I must say other countries, because they came from many parts of the world, and particularly from Rome. Well then, every September, for 7 days, the citizens of Greece and other countries gathered on the Athenian Acropolis and traveled largely on foot and at leisure, some 14 miles to the city and temples of Eleusis on the northern shore of the Saronic Gulf. And whilst all those who came apparently were permitted to participate in the preliminary ceremonies, only a carefully selected few were admitted to the sacred ceremony itself. And of course, we ask ourselves, what then occurred? Well, initiation into the mysteries, which brought about a spiritual birth, which regenerated the whole individual and united the personal self with the divine spirit of the cosmos as a whole. And this was accompanied, of course, and aided the bringing about of enlightened comprehension, wondrous inner changes of consciousness, for which perhaps we have hardly the words. Shall I say, intuitive insight. And also, yes, probably spiritual willpower and continually deepening realization of oneness with the divine life in all that exists. Yes, I presume not only that deepening experience of that oneness, but a growing power to draw upon it for the benefit of others who came into their company. And so I repeat, who knows, some of us in a former life may have been admitted to the great festival and some of its grades and secret ceremonials. Hence, our interest in this life, in secret ceremonials in general. To go on with the Eleusinian mysteries, the rites of Eleusis, with their mystic interpretation of nature's most precious secrets, overshadowed the civilizations of their time. And they gradually absorbed many smaller schools, incorporating into their own Eleusinian system, whatever valuable information these lesser institutions might have possessed. And then, as I've said also, at Agri, small town quite close to Athens, every year at Agri, the lesser mysteries were celebrated in the month of Boedromium. Does that ring at all? Boedromium. What does it mean? Well, it's the month of September, which was very, very sacred always in Greece. Even if there's a war on, they would stop in order to permit those who were interested to attend to the ceremonies of the mysteries. Yes, also it comes to my mind, excuse me slightly digressing, you know, the Olympic Games would seem to have had also a certain mysterious, I won't say mystic significance for all the people in that region. For again, even if there was a war on between those countries from which participants were to come, the war, truce was proclaimed and the fighting ceased. And the athletes from all the countries, particularly Sparta and the Peloponnesus and other surrounding countries, Thracia and elsewhere, the fighting ceased, and all the athletes were thus free. And at that time, peace reigned throughout the whole, yes, I'll use the word, celebration also of the Olympic Games. If you study about them, you do find that they were almost religiously regarded. And so, the great processions were gathered together up there on the Acropolis at Athens, where I suppose some of you have been, and may even have felt some of the atmosphere, even amidst the ruins, wonderful ruins, the great Parthenon itself, the temple of Athene, the goddess of Athens. And those who were to be initiated into the ceremonies which followed, they came to the entrance of the temple itself. There are ruins of it there at Eleusis still. And if you like, you can, in imagination, envisage the whole still standing and walk through as if in the humble guise of an admitted candidate. But those who were to be initiated came to the entrance to the sacred precinct, after which, after quite a long walk up, they came to the doors of the outer temple, which in Greek was called telestrion. Lovely words, which have a kind of ringing remembrance, perhaps, for some. So those who were going to be initiated were brought to the doors of the telestrion, passed through, and the doors closed behind them. The telestrion, translated by the by, means temple of initiation. Even so, thereafter, admission was granted to a specially secluded temple, where the lovely Greek name also are repeated, Anacteron. And it was there, in the Anacteron, that the real sacred rite itself was performed in greatest possible secrecy. Anacteron, what does that mean? Well, our nearest words, I find, are the Holy of Holies. So you came to the great gateway, then you passed through and ascended up the hill. You can still trace the path amidst the ruins and come to the doorway of the Telestrion, and if successful, would be admitted to the Anacteron and receive the sacred rite, whatever it may have been. I say that, whatever it may have been, because what actually were the revelations made during the initiatory rite into the mysteries, that is entirely unknown. Each one thus privileged evidently gave a most solemn vow under the penalty of death that they would never, never reveal that mystery. And no one, right down to modern days, has ever broken that vow. So we don't really know what did happen to the initiates. And archaeologists and historians together confess, and it does honor, does it not, to the men and women of ancient times. We have to confess that the secret has been well preserved. No one has ever disclosed what occurred and what was revealed to the initiate in the Eleusinian Anacteron, the Holy of Holies. Some came very near, and I'm going to quote from them, though apparently the real secret was preserved. Philo Judaeus, the great Alexandrian sage, wrote, "The mysteries were known to unveil the secret operations of nature." Cicero was able to write in his De Legibus these words, "Though Athens brought forth numerous divine things, yet she never created anything nobler than these sublime mysteries, through which we have become gentler and have advanced from a barbarous and rustic life to a civilized one, so that we not only live more joyfully, but also die with a better hope." Several such references one finds, though they're not direct statements, indicate that the mystery of death was solved for the candidate. And they knew that of death there was naught to be afraid, only entry into the joy of the higher consciousness. Pindar, the great lyric poet, 522-543 BC, mark you, "Happy is he who has seen the mysteries before being buried underneath the earth. He knows the end of life, and he knows its beginning, even by Zeus," meaning the Lord of all. Anyone else left us any records? Well, yes. Sophocles, the Athenian dramatist, 494 to 406 BC, evidently was admitted. He wrote, coming very near, I imagine, "Thrice happy are the mortals who depart to the abode of Hades after having seen the mysteries. They only will have life there. For others there will be nothing but suffering." He's covering up a truth, one assumes. Then Plato, the great Greek philosopher, who was, he was known to be an initiate of the Eleusinia, he wrote, "He who arrives in Hades," as the underworld after death, "he who arrives in Hades without having been initiated and without having taken part in the mysteries will be plunged into darkness. But he who has been purified and initiated will abide with the gods." Evidently something very wonderful was not only revealed, but experienced as well. Then Plutarch, if you can bear with one or two more quotes, Plutarch, the Greek biographer, 46 to 120 AD, he wrote, "Those who are initiated into the great mysteries perceive a wondrous light. Purer regions are reached, and fields where there is singing and dancing, sacred words and divine visions inspire a holy awe. Then the man," he goes on, "perfected and initiated, free and able to move superphysically, without constraint, celebrates the mysteries with a crown on his head. He lives among pure men and saints. He sees on earth the many who have not been initiated and purified, buried in the darkness, and through fear of death, clinging to their ills for want of belief in the happiness of the beyond." Anyone else? Well, yes. Scriptural evidence does exist and is confirmed, by the by H.P. Blavatsky, that St. Paul was an initiate. On what basis? Well, his own writings. May I read one or two to you? Occult tradition suggests that St. Paul was an initiate of the greater mysteries, supported by his use of certain terms from mystery rituals in his epistles. Here I quote, I won't bother with the actual references, though I have them if you want them. "As a wise master builder, I have laid the foundation. Know ye not that ye are the temple of God, and that the Spirit of God dwelleth in you? Let a man so account of us as the minister of Christ and stewards of the mysteries of God." Again, "Howbeit we speak wisdom among them that are perfect, yet not the wisdom of this world, nor of the princes of this world that come to naught. How that by revelation he made known to us the mystery of the kingdom." And then St. Paul goes very near, I think, telling, though he pretends, I assume, that he's talking about somebody else. Listen to his words. 2 Corinthians chapter 12, first four verses. He says this, I think it's himself really. "I knew a man in Christ about 14 years ago, whether in the body or out of the body, I cannot tell. God knoweth. And such an one caught up into the third heaven." And he goes on, "And I knew such a man, whether in the body or out of the body, I cannot tell. God knoweth. How that he was caught up into paradise and heard unspeakable words, which it is not lawful for a man to utter. And you may remember that our Lord himself used the word mysteries. For you remember the disciples questioned him about his custom of teaching people allegorically. So here we read, Matthew 13. And the disciples came and said unto him, Why speakest thou unto them in parables? He answered and said unto them, Because it is given unto you to know the mysteries of the kingdom of heaven, but to them it is not given. Evidently then, their master Jesus and ours had in private unveiled the inner meaning of the allegories of the ancient mysteries. So the disciples knew and could be taught direct, apparently, but not the multitude at large. Well, all these sacred procedures were carried out, we learn, in many countries, up to about the year 400 AD. Then, all of these mystic ceremonies disappeared. They came to a close. And now we have only the ruins of their temples. Wonderful, even yet, as they are in Luxor, in Karnak, in Egypt, in Delphi, in Greece, Corinth, Epidaurus, and, as I've been saying, more especially, Eleusis. The deeply occult procedure of initiation. Now, we move on now, friends, from the past, through time, or rather, shall we say, through timelessness. May I present further ideas in our study? Something like this. The deeply occult procedure of initiation has, however, continued unto today, and will ever do so. For it is a law of the spiritual life, or should I say, a law of the occult life, that no single individual ever reaches the stage at which such mystery ministrations could be helpful without fully receiving them. The law of the inner life. However, the rise of the fanatical aspects of Christianity and the cruel martyrdom of Hypatia in the 4th century in Alexandria caused the ancient mysteries to cease to be publicly celebrated. Nevertheless, as I've just ventured to say, the mystery tradition has continued. And it is now more privately active than it has ever been before, even though available in the world today in certain forms. What forms? Let us look at the spiritual and occult movements of the world today for traces of the still active mystery tradition. Well, as we do so, we might very well come to the conclusion that the opportunity for the individual aspirant would seem to be almost greater now than in olden days. If only because, perhaps, of the grievous condition of humanity today. This very grievous condition surely creates a very great need for the appearance and the activity in the world of truly illumined and selflessly dedicated human beings. Yes, gravely needed, one might say. Is this possible? Are there ways in which the principle is operative of the mysteries in the world today? Supposing some of us do feel ardently so moved, how and where would admission to the occult life and association with the great adepts be obtained? Very important question, being asked by a great many people today. May I suggest answers? Please remember that in the Theosophical Society there are no dogmas, and that everything which the speaker from a theosophical platform says is a proffered idea only, with no slightest suggestion of dogmatism or uttermost truth and rightness. However, permit me, thus covered, to make suggestions. How and where could links be found with the great hierophants of old in their present form? Well, first of all, I suggest that we as guests and members of the parent Theosophical Society, as we are now together, seated here, and the thousands of others who've joined that movement since its inception, all of us have found and have been admitted to what is firmly believed to have been an adept-inspired and adept-founded movement, and still so to be inspired. Moreover, theosophical literature contains direct references to certain great adepts. Some of the most deeply treasured literature is believed by some, all being free, to have its origin in the minds and teachings of certain great masters. For example, the Mahatma letters to A.P. Synod, H.P. Blavatsky's Isis Unveiled, The Secret Doctrine by H.P. Blavatsky, always without the slightest suggestion of dogmatic authority, seem by many to bear the characteristic of adeptic inspiration. And then the beautiful episcopal rites of ordination and the Mass in the Christian religion. These are most solemn and beautiful continuance in Christianity of the mystery tradition, I suggest, as also must be other of the most beautiful ceremonies in other religions. And then, if I may go, carry a supposed answer to our question somewhat further. For those so moved, whether theosophists or not, yes, and for those with a special inclination towards ceremonial, there does exist and is widely functioning throughout the world today an order of Freemasonry which, unlike the original, admits women to membership. And this movement, contrary to the masculine craft, admitting women to full membership, spreads and exists throughout the world, and within it, it is said, there are to be found ceremonials which are regarded by some, undogmatically, as survivals of the ancient mysteries in modern days. This movement, it is thought by some, and I'm merely offering ideas, my friends, this movement, indeed, I would incline to say, yes, Freemasonry itself is a, yes, I think I will say, is a definite continuance of the mystery tradition throughout the ages. For there the most profound ceremonials are performed. And so in these ways, in the male and female craft, admission to the rites of the ancient mysteries is possible. Anywhere else? Well, yes, very beautifully. Excuse me if I seem to be speaking too much of the Theosophical Society. My spiritual and philosophic home and source, for which no words of gratitude could ever be sufficient. There does exist also, within this movement of ours, what is called the Order of the Round Table. It was established on behalf of our theosophical young people, but for non-theosophists as well. And I believe its ceremonies of admission, following the rite of the Round Table of King Arthur and of the Order of Chivalry, another survival, I suggest, right down the ages of the ancient mysteries. From these, in these rites, spiritual powers are invoked upon the candidates, little ones and growing up, and they kneel and they are touched by the sword later on as they become knights and pass through this Order of the Round Table. You know this ceremony, friends, I'm going to stop in a minute for our break. This ceremony of the Order of Chivalry, which is known as dubbing, D-U-B-B-I-N-G, or knighthood, or knighting, I do believe is a direct descendant from the mystery tradition of old. For there, at the climax, as of old, after great vows, solemn dedication, the candidate for knighthood kneels and passes through a very mystical ceremony. The dubbing, whether in a rather philosophic order like the round table or in all ceremonies of knighting, especially by monarch, as by our Queen of the English people, Queen Elizabeth II. And Lord Tennyson, from whom I'm going to quote in closing, evidently knew this, for in his wonderful poems, which I do recommend, on the subject of the knighthood of old, you find there a very wonderful description of the ceremony of knighting as performed by King Arthur for members of his round table. And one of the knights, Sir Bedivere, describes what he saw as he watched. And Alfred Lord Tennyson, the poet laureate of England in his lifetime, thought by some to have been an initiate, he describes that in a very wonderful way, which I hope I can partly convey. Sir Bedivere is watching. King Arthur is knighting those who he regards as ready for knighthood. And listen. Then the king, in low, deep tones and simple words of great authority, bound them by so straight vows to his own self, that when they rose, knighted from kneeling, some were pale as at the passing of a ghost, some flushed, others dazed as one who wakes half blinded at the coming of a light. Listen, but when he spake and cheered his table round with large, divine, and comfortable words, beyond my tongue to tell thee, I beheld from eye to eye through all their order flash a momentary likeness of the king. There you have the true vision of the occultist. It's not only the mere hierophant, whoever he may be, it's not the monarch alone. It is he or she as an agent for the one great supreme authority on our planet, by whose power the real interior knighthood of the ancient mysteries was performed. So you see, friends, and I will continue a little after, the ancient mysteries are not lost. In these and in other ways, as I will venture to suggest, not only is there a continuance, friends, but the opportunity is available to every single individual who has begun to feel within themselves that same idealism as for King Arthur and his round table, dedicated to the cleansing of Britain of its impurities and crimes, or all others thus dedicated and thus yearning for the inward light. Every single person, it is taught, thus yearning, thus aroused, in some form or other, suited to their personality, their circumstances, perhaps their religious relationships, finds themselves drawn towards the still existing manifestation of the ancient mysteries and being drawn near to the feet of that one master whose light and life and blessing they so earnestly have sought. No one, it is taught, ever cried in vain when thus awakened. Wondrous thought. Now may I stop there and leave you for a time and continue later. Now we move on to the question which would be in the minds of most of us, I presume. How the way is kept open, and how the aspirant may find that way, and what the rules are for the successful treading of the pathway to adeptship hastened by one's mode of life. No one, as I was saying, is ever overlooked. And I find I have on my next page a quotation from Brother Lawrence. Do you know Brother Lawrence's books? If you don't, do get them. Spiritual Maxims, above all, and
practice of the presence of God.
And the practice of the presence of God. My brother Lawrence, he was a monk in the kitchen. He was a cripple of one of the monasteries some 300 or 400 years ago in France. He's left us wonderful words. And I see I added just to share with you, he who is possessed by the gale of the Holy Spirit goes forward, even in sleep. How true. For, of course, it's only the body which sleeps. And so often it is taught that it's when the body sleeps that the great contacts may possibly be made. Here is a quotation, if I may, from a letter, one of the great masters concerned with the founding of the Theosophical Society, some of its members think, all being free. This great master wrote to Mr. A.P. Sinnett, who was a man merely inquiring into the teachings of theosophy in the early days. And he asked this same question of contact. Here he living out in the world, editor of the senior newspaper in India, the Pioneer, how could he hope to contact a great adept? And hear what the master replied by letter. Like the light in the somber valley, seen by the mountaineer from his peaks, every bright thought in your mind, my brother, will sparkle and attract the attention of your distant friend and correspondent. It is thus we discover our allies in the shadow world, your world, outside the precincts. And it is our law to approach every such an one, if even there be but the feeblest glimmer of the true Tathagata light, Tathagata, divine spiritual teacher. If there be but the feeblest glimmer of the true Tathagata light within him, then how far easier for you to attract us. There's a lovely saying also, friends, I brought to share with you. If you're interested along this line, but I cannot find the source. I'll read it to you. If therefore ye are intent upon wisdom, a lamp will not be wanting, and a shepherd will not fail, and a fountain will not dry up. Of this we may rest absolutely assured. A.S.B. Blavatsky wrote, again on inspiration, some people think, these words: the light from the one master, the one unfading, golden light of spirit, shoots its effulgent beams upon the disciple from the very first. Its rays thread through the thick, dark clouds of matter. And so, this being the case, no one is ever overlooked if in our humble minds and hearts there should arise this aspiration. What may we do that on our side we may become increasingly worthy for so great a privilege as, yes, admission to the mystery tradition? Well, the ideal was wonderfully defined by the Lord Buddha concerning this very point and further development towards Buddhahood. The ideal is named in Pali by a strange word, Paridhamma, P-A-R-I, Nama. Parinamana. What's it mean? Well, it means declaration of altruism and self-denial. Here is how it's described. The individual is called upon to apply wholly one's merit to the welfare of others. Parinamana. And the aspirant says, we aspirants must presumably say the same. Whatever good I have acquired by doing all this, may I appease and assuage all the pains and sorrows of all living beings. May I be like a healing drug for the sick. May I be a physician for them and also tend them till they are whole. May I allay the pain of hunger and thirst by showers of food and drink. And may I myself be food and drink during the intermediate eon of famine. And may I be an inexhaustible treasure for poor creatures. May I be foremost in rendering service to them with manifold and various articles and requisites. A wonderful surrender, you see, of the whole thought of any self-gain whatever, outgrown, completely replaced by that of the joyous sharing with all. There is another Buddhist way of saying this. The golden keys to the portal of the temple of the mysteries. Again, we owe this transition of teachings to Madame Blavatsky. She gives us what are called the seven paramitas, or perfections. Students of Buddhism amongst you and Buddhists will know that word. What are the seven paramitas? Dana, the key of charity and love immortal. Sila, the key of harmony in word and act. The key that counterbalances the cause and the effect. Shanti, patience sweet that naught can ruffle. Vairagya, indifference to pleasure and pain. Illusion conquered, truth alone perceived. Virya, the dauntless energy that fights its way to the supernal truth out of the mire of the terrestrial. Sixth, the dhyana, whose golden gate, once open, leads to a sinless being, a saint. The golden gate, once open, leads towards the realm of bliss eternal and its ceaseless contemplation. And seven, prajna, wisdom, the key which makes a man a god, creating him a bodhisattva, son of the dhyanis. Such are the golden keys to the portals. Before thou canst approach the last, O weaver of thy freedom, thou hast to master these paramitas of perfection, the virtues transcendental. Now I close with a further wonderful contribution of training and guidance in training for the fulfillment of this great ideal of finding one's own specially suited pathway to the hidden light, or if so moved, the feet of one's own master. or further, if ceremonially inclined, approach to an admission through the door of the temple of the mysteries, there by the great Hierophant, to feel the touch of the thyrsus upon one's head, to lose the limitations of body consciousness and free to ascend into the awareness of eternal bliss. Available, friends, available. How one more wonderful guidance. With this I close. It's called the Golden Stairs. A clean life, an open mind, a pure heart, an eager intellect, an unveiled spiritual perception, a brotherliness for all, a readiness to give and receive advice and instruction, a courageous endurance of personal injustice, a brave declaration of principles, a valiant defense of those who are unjustly attacked, and a constant eye to the ideal of human progression and perfection which the sacred science depicts. These are the golden stairs up the steps of which the learner may climb to the temple of divine wisdom. H. P. Blavatsky. And with that quotation and gratitude to her, I close my personal contribution to our subject and am willing to try and answer your questions. Not sounding properly? Oh yes, I brought with me. Which of the
Tennyson's?
Oh,
the poem of Tennyson.
Oh yes, the Ideals of a King, or you would say the Ideals of a King, Tennyson. The whole of that aspect of Tennyson's work, under that main heading, The Ideals of the King, is devoted utterly to this whole scheme of, yes, the service of the King. Not only the physical, visible King, but the great, presumed, spiritual King of the world. So that's Tennyson's Ideals of the King. Do read it. It's full of beauty and wonder.
Another request for a reference.
Yes, the Tagore poem about the dewdrop and the sun. Well, that's taken from the collected poems and plays of Rabindranath Tagore. And under the chapter heading of Fruit Gathering, his charming way of naming his work. This book, Collected Poems and Plays of Rabindranath Tagore, published by the Macmillan Company, New York City, and was reprinted in 1945. Oh, I've just received a message to say that the round table to which I referred and wherein the whole practice for the very young people, though not limited to them, of training from beginning with being a page, and then a companion, and then an esquire. That's the stage next to knighthood, through which all the old members of the Order of Chivalry passed, until the king thought them worthy to receive the knighthood. And then the esquire became a knight. Well, this order of the Round Table is carried out here in this Theosophical Society. And may I say, I've had the privilege of participating many times here with large groups of lovely young people. If you're interested, then consult Mrs. Sarah Jordan, who will give you, or someone else, the necessary information. Thank you, dear. Yes. Can you comment on the place of Mithras in the evolution of enlightenment and his relation as a bringer of light to the Christ, the light of the world? I wouldn't quite go as far as the last, but certainly the rites of Mithras are regarded by some scholars, I find, as having been a manifestation of the mystery tradition. Its development, as probably you know, out of the teachings of Zarathustra, the great Persian founder of that Parsi religion, and it had, like all of them, its own interior mystic and initiatory essence and developments. Highly allegorical, founded upon the story of the birth and life of Mithras. I haven't time to go into it now, but in the library you'll be able to read all about it. I've studied it somewhat, and I've come to believe from it, and especially from the remarkable pictures of Mithras himself and all the symbology associated with it, that it was a mystery rite. You know, it was very strong, was the rite of Mithras. It very nearly displaced Christianity. In the very early centuries of the Christian religion, it became very strong indeed. Nearly all the Roman soldiery adopted it and took it to Britain. And by the way, in England, there are certain statues and carvings from that rite of Mithras still there, brought there and left by the Roman soldiery. It was a very, very powerful organization indeed. Don't say, friend, that the Lord Jesus Christ took his teachings from that particular source. That, I think, would be going too far. In any case, you would have no proof. You have written that diabetes is karmically a result of some great disappointment. Could this relate to the present subject in any way? No, I don't think so. No. But may I say here, friends, in all of this, such questions and such matters, it's never safe to generalize. I can't generalize. Bring the case before me, please, and then I'll examine and pass an opinion for what it may be worth. The subject's too profound for such generalizations. Excuse me, please. But that general thought, yes. But whether it applies to the path only, I cannot say. As I remember when I was doing that work and writing that book, no, it was to do with personal life more completely. That is to say that I found that many people consulting me who were suffering or had suffered from diabetes had in their lives very great and grievous, even shocking disappointments. And curiously, one way in which this seemed to have worked out physically was by diabetes. Again, a mere offering, all being free. Is it wise for a beginner in theosophical studies to try to raise the kundalini through classes taken for this purpose. Definitely and positively, may I be on record here by all. Definitely no. Very, very dangerous indeed. Don't touch it unless you're under the guidance of an expert who can advise you, in the first place, whether you should begin, in the second place, how you should begin, and more especially, to help you if things should go awry. They very might be wrong. Very easily right. No, never. I am studying this with you later on. And I'll bring some slides and we'll see what Kundalini is and how it works. But in no sense do I, or should anyone else, ever advise a person, unless under an adept teacher, to arouse this tremendous force in nature and in themselves. It's of tremendous potency, friend. Do be careful, won't you, if any of you are tempted as well you may be, to experiment in this field without the aid of an adequate teacher. Oh, don't ask me this. Can a person receive adeptship in the Roman Catholic Church? Nothing, they have nothing to do with each other, friend. The attainment of adeptship is an entirely, 100% interior procedure. And it doesn't matter whether you're a Hindu or a Parsi or a Buddhist or even an atheist. If you are following the golden stairs that I read to you, or the parinamanas, or the paramitas, it doesn't matter whether you're a member of any of the religion or none. The whole is an interior experience, an awakening within the soul of what can only be described as a yearning for direct interior experience of oneness with the divine light and life in all that exists, and moreover, an insistent longing that will not be still to place the results at the service of one's fellow men. That's the only way, whether you're a Roman Catholic or what you are. Follow that way, and the path will be found, and the door of the temple also, and it will be opened. Are any of the greater or lesser mysteries revealed in studies of plant and animal life? Not, I presume to suggest, not directly, but remember this. Excuse me if that was a little dogmatic. The capacity to study plant life, the power to look into and pass the sheer physical form and touch that divine presence within that life, that plant, that leaf, that flower, that tree, that is connected directly with the mystery tradition and the awakening of one's own spiritual unfoldment. That is necessary before, by direct experience, not with instruments, mark you, though I'm not criticizing those, knowing the work of Baxter and others, even have some work myself in that direction. But I have found that the only way really to get into touch personally with the life in plants and feel and know what little degree of consciousness and responsiveness there may be there, you must have awakened a little of the same consciousness in yourself. When one reaches total inner illumination, will one have clairvoyant abilities? Not necessarily. Are clairvoyant abilities something to be desired? Not necessarily. They're external. They're results, you must remember, not prime goals at all. They're results. True, if you have once become moved with the desire or determination, that will never be denied, to discover truth direct for yourself and to know it without question, without dependence on any external source, then you need both the spiritual awakening and a certain development of clairvoyant power. Yes, then. But remember and never forget, the goal is not the development of clairvoyant and occult and other powers. These come along naturally. The real goal is interior realization of oneness with the Supreme Presence in all that lives and in all others, like us here, seated here together, all different, each with our different name, each with our characters, and each with our tasks in life, ages and degree of health or otherwise, all apparently in our bodies different. But the really illumined person, I imagine, would say to us, not at all. You and we are all, in the reality of our existence, but one. That's the goal. That's the goal. A story came into my mind. Shall I tell it? It's a story of something that happened in India, in one of the Christian churches in India. There are a number. And in one of the parishes, it was Christmas Day, and great preparations had been made, and the members of the church and all the people were greatly prepared to come to church for the wonderful celebration of Christmas Mass or Holy Communion, and probably a sermon, and the rejoicing in Christmas Day. And the church was all decorated. It was full. And the vicar's wife was there, the organ. And the time for the opening of the ceremony came. No sign of the vicar. And they waited, and she waited anxiously until somebody came running from the vicarage saying that, tragically, the vicar had suddenly passed away. Well, you could imagine what that must have meant. She did not know what to do. She happened to look round, and there, standing in the doorway, was a yogi in the yellow robe. Now, what I'm going to say, friends, isn't very dramatic, special, but it has a message for us. There was this yogi standing in the doorway of the church, and she was so distraught and so at loss. She didn't know where to turn, so it was another religion, but she turned to him. They are supposed to know more than the rest of us. And she turned to him and she said, would you please come up and talk to my people who have had this grave loss on Christmas morning? So he walked up in front of the altar and faced the people and said only a very few words. Don't expect anything wonderful. He said, every day is Christmas Day. Christ is always being born. Oh, how true. Not only on Christmas Day. And it's this, friends, if I could only make clearer and clearer, this interior, as St. Paul did, I travail in birth, he wrote, to his people, I travail in birth again, that the Christ may be formed in you. This is it. Various ways of describing the inner spiritual experience, which, yes, I suppose, is really indescribable. Is co-masonry derived from the masculine obedience? Oh, yes, very definitely. I thought I made that clear. There is only one Freemasonry, of course, a single one. There is the masculine obedience, as it's called, and co-Masonic obedience, which does admit females to membership. But all are under one and have derived from one source, which I personally believe is the mystery tradition. Too private. You better speak to me, friend. This is, I cannot answer this question publicly. Too serious, too private, and too involved. So if you feel so moved when I've gone out there now, just follow, or Sandra will help you, and you can. I will answer as well as I can.